Ed Cameron's, now Al Bielek's, journey through time started when he jumped off the USS Eldridge in 1943 during the Philadelphia Experiment. Both he and his brother Duncan Cameron landed in the year 2137 and remember waking up in a hospital bed. During that stay, Ed alone traveled to the year 2749 and spent 2 years there. In this program, Al recounts his memories of that trip. Al, can you describe what the civilization was like in the year 2749?
What I saw of this civilization was a highly advanced civilization and technologically. We had floating cities, we had ground-based cities. The floating ones are anti-gravity type flotation. 2100, 2200 stories, like the cities are 2.5 miles high. And in retrospect, I have looked at that and says, now how the blazes, with any materials that we know in the 20th century, how could they build anything that would sustain that kind of weight from the stories above it? And of course, it was explained to me at that time in the 28th century that it was very easy to explain because they had conquered at full control over anti-gravity and multiple systems of anti-gravity in which they built platforms of every 300 floors approximately. And they would relieve the strain of the pressure from above with an anti-gravity reverse system so that the pressure from above disappeared. So that each section only had to support its own weight, and they kept adding sections as they built this city up to 2,100, 2,200 stories. And in addition, if they wanted the city to be a floating city, it was a floating city. And they would move it around from one part of the earth, if we got tired of it, to another part of the earth. They were interested in that. And I told them about the system of governing, if you will, which was a totally synthetic system, actually, in synthetic intelligence computers. They were moderately interested in that. I said they had one in each city. Whether the city was fixed, which there were fixed cities doing manufacturing and so forth, or it was a floating city. Why they had floating cities moving around, I don't know, but that was a civilization as it was then, or is to be, if you will. And I started to ask questions. I had friends there, and I stayed long enough to learn all about the functions of the city and the fact that this synthetic intelligence was a highly radioactive crystalline form structure, so far as I could tell, because I was called in for an interview, and to be interviewed, you had to put on a lead-lined suit, completely radiation-proof, because in the room where this computer was, where you were interviewed, which computer, if I can call it that, was a huge crystalline structure floating in the middle of the room. No physical connections to anything we could see. And it would interview you telepathically. And I was called in for more than one interview. And I gathered the structure of the society at that time was purely socialism, 100% pure socialism. Everything was free. There were no banks. There was no money. You were born into the society by your parents. Your parents could be living in a common law arrangement. They could be married. You could be raised by your parents, or you could be raised by the state.
Well, what did the computer want to know from you?
Eventually wanted to know what I was doing there and what I knew about how I got there. At that point, I didn't remember anything about how I got there. It was sort of like I arrived and became part of this city, part of the society, like I had been born in it, but which was not the case. There was some false memories involved and a huge block as to where I'd been, how I got there, what was I doing there. I sort of absorbed the place and became part of me, and I became part of it, so to speak. And one tour guide I became very friendly with, as I found out much later.
Isn't that what you were? You were a tour guide, weren't you?
I became a tour guide of sorts because I adopted this profession. Everybody was expected to get an education, a minimal education, and then, of course, contribute something to society, do something useful. Mm-hmm. But this manufacturing, being a tour guide, a scientist, an engineer, whatever, manufacturing.
What did you give tours of?
The city, basically.
To
because
tourists?
Because people came to these cities from elsewhere on the planet. Mm-hmm. And they would like to see all of the workings, particularly the floating cities, where did they go, what did they do, and the cities based on the ground had these transportation tubes, they called oscillotrons. It was sort of like a moving sidewalk. They had one type, which was a moving sidewalk, you jump on a thing and move through the city, you can jump off where you wanted. The other was a tube type apparatus where you jump in a thing and it would propel you, similar to the Montauk operation, but it was a localized, much slower thing, mm-hmm. in which you were propelled through the tube to a sort of like a continuous belt. You get on it and you get off where you wanted to get off, mm-hmm. at some other part of the city. The kids used to love this thing. It was entertainment for them. And I became part of a guide for that. We'd take people from outside that didn't see these things very often or from another part of the world, and we'd show them around, show them this particular operation, the city, and what was in that city. So that was what the tour guides were for. They literally showed outsiders what was going on in their particular city. Obviously, not all the cities were the same. But it was interesting that there was no external structure of government other than the local government of each city. There was a city-state, if you will, i.e. each city was a rule and a law unto itself, though they all followed a common format in terms of the fact that each city was ruled by the synthetic intelligence. And as I found out, each synthetic intelligence unit was connected to the rest. So there was a worldwide network, a worldwide web, if you will. Well, I asked a lot of questions. Well, what about war? What's that? Unknown. Well, the unit which I talked with, the particular intelligence system, we had a nickname for them. We called it the Lama, much like the Lama in a monastery.
The Dalai Lama.
Yes, much mm-hmm. like the Dalai Lama, if you will. I asked them, well, wasn't there war in the past? They said, oh, yes, we had wars in the past. I said, that's long gone. I said, are there any armies, standing armies, or military operations, military organizations? None. No soldiers? No. No military? No. No Navy? No. No Air Force? No. No satellite system? He wouldn't answer that one. Well, do you have means in case of something like an invasion from outside? Suppose somebody from outside wanted to come in and take over the planet. Do you have means of defending yourself? He said, yes, we do. I said, what are they? He says, you do not have the need to know. But he says, we have means to defend the cities. Apparently they had, shall we say, built-in armaments, perhaps high-powered laser systems, perhaps more advanced systems. I don't know. I never found out. But they had the means to defend each individual city as such. And apparently it was never needed.
What were the cities like? I mean, were they colorful? Were they large? Were they comfortable?
Some were large. Some were smaller. They were definitely very comfortable. The apartments one we were assigned to or lived in were very comfortable. They had all the modern conveniences that we know today, plus some.
What would be different?
What would be different
as a convenience that, say, we don't have right now?
Yeah, that says I have to go back a bit to remember that, going back to the future, if you will.
I hear you.
They had synthetic food units, I remember, in the apartments. You could have fresh produce brought in, or you could synthesize either way you preferred. They did have restaurants, and there were, of course, stores to go shopping in. You could buy stuff if you wanted to. Buy, of course, is a misnomer. They did set up a limitation. In other words, if everything was free, a person could go out and literally grab anything they wanted. There had to be a limit against this sort of thing, of literally purging a store of everything they had because you wanted it and wanted this, 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 and this. There had to be a limitation. There was a form of credit, which was a rather obscure type of credit system. It wouldn't be on a monetary credit basis, but depending on your position in the society, you were allowed to have a certain comfort level, if you will. Certain things you were allowed to have to buy, if you wanted to call it to buy, to go acquire. And in terms of entertainment, they had television, if I remember correctly now, they had radio of sorts. They had theater, they had many of the things which we have today, except they've been carried a little bit further. And they did have travel. You could travel to another city. They did have rail systems that covered, at least where I was in the United States. They had rail systems allegedly all over the planet, but they were not like we have them today. The rail systems were much wider. They were at least twice the width track-wise. The cars were two and a half times as wide. They were longer. And they were made out to be much more like an excursion trip, if you will, like you would go on an ocean liner, on an excursion, or on a cruise. You would take a cruise on a train, if you will. You would get on it, and you'd have bands, you would have all kinds of entertainment, this sort of thing. You'd go across the country.
Did you ever see a map of the world of that time period?
Not that I recall now.
So you did at 2137, though,
right?
Oh,
yes. In 2137, I did. I did not see a map of the world at that era of 28th century. I'm sure they existed, but I don't recall that they were shown. In fact, I didn't see it because it was not part of society. You weren't told much about what was on the outside. And there were those people, the heretics, as they call them, who didn't want to be part of the society, this regimented socialism, if it were. It was free to a point, but it was also regimented, because you had rules and regulations, and you were told this is the limits of what you could do. If you went outside of that, there's sort of a yellow zone, you were called in, the Lama gave you a reprimand. If you went in the red zone, it was a very serious case, like you would have today if somebody committed murder. Well, they had rules involving that kind of society, rules and regulations. And if you went outside of the normal zone or the red zone, you were called in for not just a reprimand. Many people disappeared, were never seen again. Now, whether they were eliminated on the spot or not, I can only assume that that was probably what happened to them. And they did have automobiles, though I never went out in one, and I understand there wasn't that much car travel. For those who were on the surface cities, they had to have transportation.
Did everybody look pretty much the same, physically?
There were variations in the human appearance, but the human appearance had changed a great deal in the sense that it was more refined. There was less variation in appearance than there is now. There was more of a genetic mold, which had much narrower limits than you see today genetically. I don't recall at this point in the 20th century that there was more than one race. It was Caucasian. I don't remember seeing any other races. Now, outside of where I was, because I never took any long trips anyplace, there might well have been other races elsewhere in other parts of the planet that I never found out about, never inquired. What intrigued me was the fact that here is a synthetic intelligence computer running this whole system and actually running the planet. These things didn't build themselves. Who built them? That was where it got much more interesting, because eventually I was introduced to the builders of the intelligence system. The computer systems. Who were the designers? Who were the builders? That's when I met this group. They were different. They were totally human, but they were different than the ones you typically saw. They ran 6'2", 6'3", average, extremely intelligent. Genetically, I guess about as perfect as you could expect anyone to get. They were the result, as they told me, of genetic engineering that had been ongoing for centuries. And it was in the 26th century they perhaps came from a long line of computer engineers. It was in the 26th century they decided to engage in the experiment of synthetic intelligence to see if they could run the whole planet.
Probably Bill Gates' great-great-great-great-grandson.
Very possibly. Maybe Bill Gates' grandchildren or great-grandchildren. But that was the way I was introduced to them, and that they were running everything behind the scenes. They kept totally out of sight. They didn't interfere with the computer operations unless something went wrong, and apparently there was one case of where the way the computers were programmed, as I understand it, they had a wide latitude of operation, a wide latitude of what they could do, but there was one inbuilt function which was allegedly inviolate. They could never lie to anyone about anything. If they felt it inappropriate to give an answer on something, you just say, I can't give you an answer on that at this point, or that's not in your domain or whatever, but they wouldn't lie about it. One of them did lie, apparently, at one time, and one of them was scrapped and replaced. I felt there was some basic flaw in that unit that had gotten to the point where it could assume to lie, whatever the reason was, it was destroyed.
Was its name Hal?
From the famous movie?
Yeah.
Not that I know of.
Well, they say history repeats itself, you know.
Good point.
Yeah.
As I got to meet these people, I got to learn a lot more about prior history, prior to this point. And as they said, they had undergone genetic engineering themselves from a 22nd and 23rd century, and they emerged as the, perhaps one would say, the dominant intelligent species on Earth. They had a name for themselves, which I'll give you in a minute or two. But they, literally the power behind the scene running this whole thing, and they were beginning to realize something, which I've learned since, perhaps because of their writings, which have come back to this century. There was a major flaw, which they realized was possible, from what they told me, but it was only beginning to show up in the 28th century. And that was the fact that if you have pure socialism, a set of guidelines where society must adhere to, and everything's free, you lose incentive to create. You lose that creative ability. And you just fall into the pattern, and the pattern remains unchanging. There are no new inputs, and eventually the whole damn thing will collapse because there's no reason to go ahead and do anything new. There's no reason to create anything new, and people will get tired of the same old thing eventually. And if they see nothing changing, no future, nothing that they can help to create, then that creative impulse is gone, and eventually society collapses and dies.
Well, that's very strange because, I mean, you could look to present-day Soviet Union and find the same example there. That's why communism
fell. You certainly can. Communism is socialism under another name.
Yeah, so it's odd that they wouldn't have looked back into history to learn that lesson before creating the society they created.
Well, one of the things they looked at and had perhaps as a consideration was the fact that in the 22nd, 23rd century, the world population was only around 300 million total. Mm. And there was a definite decision, and of course this is in current day's data, the New World Order feels that the world, ideal world population would be around 500 million. It shouldn't be over 1 billion. The natural resources and such cannot support it, sustain it indefinitely, which is beginning to show. But as part of that assumption of this century, apparently they considered the same thing, that the maximum desirable population on the planet should be around 500 million, and they were aiming everything at that 500 million population, which is where it was in the 28th century. And it was approaching that in the 25th, perhaps, from what they told me. But they wanted to try and make a system of socialism work because they didn't want to go back to all of the evils and the problems of the banking systems, particularly private banking, which have existed in the last 10 centuries of this up to this time. And they didn't want to see that repeated with everything leading into wars and fights for the sake of profit and what it did to humanity. Well, of course, that's one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is it goaded humanity into advances. You create a problem, you find a solution. Whether the solution is how to beat your enemy in war or how to get out into space before somebody else does or whatever it may be, go to defend yourself against an invasion, it creates a desire, an incentive for something which in the long run becomes perhaps productive and adds to the sum total knowledge of humanity. But they felt, for whatever their reasons and choices, that they wanted to try the grand experiment with socialism controlled by a highly intelligent synthetic intelligence system rather than by humans, because they realized if humans control this, it gets out of hand. You get an elite group who runs the show and runs it for their own benefit and their own profit, which is exactly what's going on the planet today.
So were any of these computer programmers taking advantage of the fact that they wrote the program that controls everything? Or were they?
As far as I could tell, they did not. They were really,
because they could have then controlled the world
with
that power.
In a sense, they already did, because they created the computers, and if they found that a computer went out of its bounds of its own programming limits, they would pull it and replace it.
But they were pretty good folks then.
Apparently, they were what you might call the perfect human.
Yeah.
That's hard to say in a certain sense, but they seemed to be that. They had no self-desires in terms of gaining power or control.
They were not ambitious.
They were not ambitious.
Huh.
And it's a very peculiar thing because they also had, separate from the main cities, they had their own culture, they had their own art, their own, I wouldn't say religious beliefs, but their own philosophical beliefs, which had gone beyond religion. religion didn't exist, I might add, in the 20th century. It was almost non-existent in 2137.
What did they think of God, or what was their concept of God?
They did think of a supreme being, but they thought of it in a very different sense than most religions do today. Most religions today take a very narrow view of the punishing God and the rewarding God, and you do what he says, everything's fine. If you don't, he'll punish you. That's long gone in terms of their outlook. It's considered a supreme being that it is very difficult to get to know, that is beyond all of us in terms of awareness and understanding. But it, the God, learns through communicating through us and contacting us and being part of our experience, that we are part of God just as God is part of us, and it's a two-way street type thing. It's a reciprocal arrangement, if you will. And the God is beyond the physical universe as we know it, but maintains contact with the physical universe through us. And that was apparently their attitude and their religion. And you can find that information today in the network, in the net, and so forth, under the name of the Wingmakers, because that is what they call themselves. And according to what has turned up in current time, and I remember what they told me, they had made stashes all over the earth in about the 8th century A.D., which had been uncovered in the 20th century and into the 21st century. Three have been recovered so far, one in New Mexico, which was the first one.
Well, stashes of what, though?
Of their literature, of their science, of their...
This is the Wingmakers you're talking about?
This is a buried underground, what would you call them? Time capsules, perhaps, is what the best thing they were, to show what their art and there was that they had, their music, their technology, and whether or not there was a warning involved, that's hard to say, because it fell immediately in the first site with the Chaco Canyon in New Mexico, fell immediately under the control of NSA.
So are you saying that these engineers, these computer software engineers...
They're human engineers as well, and genetic engineers initially.
Okay, are you saying that they were actually a byproduct of the Wingmakers?
They were the Wingmakers.
They were the Wingmakers, okay. And the Wingmakers then are alive and well today,
They're alive 2000. And well today in the 28th century. They can apparently travel to this era, but they're not living per se in this era, mm-hmm. meaning the 20th century, 21st century. But they built these stashes, and one of them was found in 1983 approximately in Chaco Canyon, New Mexico. On the surface, there was an Indian mound and an Indian burial site, which, according to all of the geologists and archaeologists who looked at it, fitted the 8th century A.D. Everything fitted except they found one artifact in there that didn't fit at all, and that's what brought in NSA. There was a compass. Indians didn't have compasses. So NSA came in, then they thought this might be an alien stash, so they put in the ACIO, which is Advanced Contact Intelligence Organization, a super secret group within NSA, with a certain secret group within that. And they couldn't find anything more than the compass, so 11 years later, they buried the thing, covered it over. I don't mean buried it physically in terms of rubble. They buried it in terms of an invisibility shield, and they totally hid the site. And about 1994, there's a earthquake in the area. Canyon wall comes down. And they find, after that, they went back to check it, and they found there was an entrance into an underground cavern system with a spiral staircase carved in the solid rock and a series of 23 rooms. And this information, of course, has been made available because one of the head archaeologists involved with it decided the government had no right to keep this secret. So we put it out on the net. Now, whether he's still alive or not, we don't know, but they didn't get all the information out.
Do you know who he was?
Only by his code name, is Dr. Alexander. That's not his real name.
Okay.
And he held a level 12 clearance in the current terminology of this century's clearance levels in the U.S. government. There's up to a level 15 and beyond, probably. But a 15 was a director who was only known by the number 15. Nobody called him by his name, but... He was part of the ACIO operation, and Alexander broke his, his oath of secrecy in bringing the information out and getting it put on the net. But he had to crack the codes of what they found in the 23rd room, and that was an optical disc. Standard type like we know today, except they couldn't break the code. And NSA has some pretty damn good code breakers. Mm-hmm. And there are some very good code breakers in the government. None of them could break it. Anderson went to work on it. It took him a year and a half. He knew something like 20 languages, including ancient Sanskrit.
Did you actually know this individual, Mr. Alexander?
No.
Okay, so this is secondhand knowledge.
This is based off of the manuscripts taken off the network and the interviews of him by the one woman who put this whole manuscript on the Internet.
All right, this is about the Internet. Okay.
Right.
I'm trying to tie this story that you're telling right now back to...
Well, I'll tie that together.
Okay.
And the information was buried at this time and era, and according to the interviews, of which two were on the net, they built seven of these stashes around the planet about the 8th century A.D., with the intent that they be found at some time in the future when the technology caught up with what they had accomplished and done in the way of hiding sites and burying them and recognizing certain key things like that compass that didn't belong with the Indian stash. So, you know, ACI got into it. They finally realized when they broke the code on the optical disc, which gave the whole history, gave them a lot of the science and technology, which apparently was not released on the net, that this was not somebody from outside. This was a group of time travelers out of the future. And they put this stash, and that's what they said on the optical disc. We did this here. The art is strange. If you see any of their work in the manuals, I can show you a manual, but I don't need to put it in this collection because it is available on the net still, so far as I know. If it turns out it's not available, we can add it to this. But their purpose, they stated, was to guide humanity through some very rough periods. And apparently their desire at this time, in having this stash, and now three uncovered, which to say there's four more, to be uncovered essentially at the tail end of the 20th century, was the fact that we face a very major crisis in human history right about this time. And this is, of course, whether we go down the road of total blatant government control, a total dictatorship, or whether we retain, as in the U.S. and the Western nations, whether we retain a institution which is really called a constitutional republic, not a democracy. And many of the nations of Europe also retain their republic status, or whether they go back to a monarchy system, or whether they go back to something worse. There is a saddle point right at this time, at the beginning of the 21st century. Which way is humanity going to go? And that's one of the reasons the stashes were placed where we found at this time. And they're realizing that there must be communication back to this era, and there must be some kind of guidance to get humanity through a very rough period. Because they face the possibility that, because time is not frozen in a celluloid strip which is unchangeable, the whole thing throughout the entire loop, which is a time loop, is, shall we say, malleable. It is plastic. It can be reshaped. It can be changed. The past is essentially fixed. In terms of us, what is our past is essentially fixed, but it's not entirely true. It can be re-engineered and has been.
But are they coming back to make their actual present time better? Is that their goal?
Their goal is to straighten, as I understand it, and trying to put this together myself, their goal is to try and straighten out some of the problems they realize they now have in the future, because in the year 3000 AD on, apparently there's no life on the planet. 6037 AD is dead. There's no life. And this, of course, is something which is not a desirable outcome for humanity.
Okay, so they're still there in the 28th century,
yeah.
But what they're seeing is that year 3000, or somewhere around there, life is dead.
Someplace around there, they're dead, whether it's because of an alien invasion or because of a collapse of our society due to...
But don't they have the ability to time travel in the future? Obviously, they
I'm
can
sure
go
they
in, the,
do.
In the past, so they should know what happened then.
Well, that's one of the reasons why I believe they're coming back to the present, or will be coming back to the present, and one of the reasons why their stashes are being uncovered at this time.
Right. So there, this must be a real pivotal point.
It is a very pivotal point.
The year 2000.
10 years, let's say from 1990 through 2012, or let's say 1992 through 2012, if you want to put it in terms of a 20-year bracket. Because of the information we're getting through leakage from friends of mine who have connections with the near future, saying that there will be a world war in 2003, and there will be enormous destruction. All of the people who have looked at the, shall we say, the trends of history, as well as the predictions by various sources, both biblical and otherwise, indicate a tremendous war sometime in this decade, which will be very, very destructive to humanity and not leave much.
Well, when you went to 2137, did they talk about huge war?
They did.
Did they
date it? I was in the records. There had been a war in the 21st century, which essentially that and all the earth changes, which came all about the same time, were over by the year 2025, and from that point on they started to rebuild, but there wasn't much left to rebuild with, except they still had the technology. They hadn't lost it. Mm-hmm. Consequently, they had to start nearly from scratch, not quite. If it hadn't been for the nuclear subs with their optical discs, if it hadn't been for the fact that some cities were unscathed and had a basis of technology and manufacturing left so they could rebuild the rest of what they wanted, it would have been a much worse situation. Mm. Now, this is what I saw based on my departure point, which was 1943. Now, from 43 to now, meaning 2000, the year 2000, a lot of things have happened. A lot of people have changed their ideas. And there has been a very pivotal change in Earth's history in terms of what has happened in the last 5 years. Nostradamus, the famous seer of Virginia Beach, Virginia, and many
Edgar
others.
Casey.
Edgar Casey. Mm-hmm. And certain other people who have looked into the future have all saw a huge calamity befalling Earth in the last decade of this century, that is the 20th century, the last decade between 1990 and 2000. And many of them predicted a comet hitting Earth. Well, let us look at history, namely Hale-Bopp, 1998. Hale-Bopp came in close, passed around the Earth, this, speaking in terms of history as we know it, passed around the Earth at a safe distance and went on its way and split into six pieces after it passed the Earth. However, that's only telling the outward story. Hale and Bopp discovered it 2 years prior, and they were given credit for it because they were the first astronomical scientists to see it that were of public record. And I emphasize a public record because of the fact that it was known to the military and to NASA 10 years before that. Hale-Bopp was the largest comet ever to enter our system, and it was followed by an object behind it, which was denied by all of the media and by all of the scientific groups because they didn't want the public to know what was going on. Hale-Bopp, of course, we have good computers today, and speaking of 1997-98, they predicted the course of the comet, of course. And the first one said pass near the Earth but around it. Then they noticed there was a course correction. And they said, oh, it's getting cold, going to come much closer to the Earth. And there was another course correction. At what point, I don't know, because I have not had access to all of the records. Only a certain friend of mine who was involved in this project knew. They knew it was on a direct collision course with Earth because it was being aimed directly at Earth. And they could predict this with the computers as much as a year, perhaps, before Hale-Bopp, quote, discovered the comet, unquote.
Now, this information you're sharing with our listeners, where did this come from? Is this something that you knew about?
No, it comes from military sources and a friend of mine.
Okay.
Who was involved in this project.
That was a project to blow up Hale-Bopp.
Montauk, mm-hmm. Yeah, which okay. was called Operation Sky Pebbles. It was mm-hmm. an Air Force project.